Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard the Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
Welcome to another episode of the Had to Go Out podcast. We have some insanely great news to share with you today. We made the Commandant's 2019 professional reading list. So thank you guys for all your support and for listening and for making that happen. Very cool, very privileged, very honored to be on there. Huge thanks to all you regular listeners. Keep those likes, shares, and positive reviews coming. If you have a suggestion on what we can do better, we're on every social media platform, so just send us a direct message.
If you haven't given us a review yet, especially on iTunes, please do think about highlighting those 5 stars. Every review makes a huge difference, helps us build our audience, and it helps us make this podcast better for you.
And if you like what we're doing, consider clicking that support us link on our Anchor FM profile so we can just deliver more and better going forward. Things take money, and the more support we get, the more we can do. I promise you that. If this is your first time tuning in, get stoked, because this one is going to be epic. I do not know our guest personally, but I know his name, and I know of him, and I've seen him around, and I've seen him on tons of Coast Guard materials, tons of press releases. If you don't recognize the name, I guarantee you that you will after this one. Our guest today is Mr. Mario Vitone, a retired warrant, retired in 2013. You got me there. He's born and raised out of Cheverly, Maryland. Joined the Navy first back in 83. Did a six-year stint as a squid as Navionics Tech on the USS Coral Sea. Realized his mistake and wanted to become a rescue swimmer in the Navy. They wouldn't let him change rates, so joined the Coast Guard in 91 to make that happen. Was in recruit company Charlie 139 on the ceremonial detail. Had to go back to being a non-rate because he just refused to do that avionics technician. He had a mission that he wanted to do and stuck to his guns, and they made him be a non-rate again for it. He nearly became the bandmaster at Cape May. Said he didn't want to play Semper Paratus for the rest of his life. I cannot blame him on that one.
It's a great song.
It is a great song, but it would be tough every day. So he went ahead and got orders to the Coast Guard cutter Point Franklin. Almost became a bosun mate. Almost, right? He had the leader there that was leading him in the right direction. But right before he successfully struck it, he got orders to Aviation Survivalman. That's ASM A School, the precursor to the ASTs. Graduated as class 360, or no, graduated as rescue swimmer number 368. It was class 6494. First air station out of there was Air Station E City, so he didn't have to travel far. Some insane promotions happened in some insanely strange ways, but promoted to E5 by Field Promotion, which if you're not familiar, there's a reason for that because it never happens.
But it is a real thing. We just proved it.
And we did. He got out to take care of his family back in 96. In 02, he came back into the Coast Guard, started off at Air Station New Orleans, transferred to Station Elizabeth City, where he made E6, his first and only service-wide in the Coast Guard to advance. 2016, made enlisted person of the year for the entire service, was, again, not field promotable, was advanced to E7 off that, and became the chief of Aviation Survival Technician A School. Later went on to make warrant, assigned to Sector Hampton Roads under the Marine Safety Specialty, meaning that he investigated why accidents happened and what caused them, and then retired after 22 years of faithful service in January 2013. And with that, we have Mr. Mario Vitone on the line, and I'm going to ask Bill to ask the question.
Afternoon, Mr. Vitone. So the question is, what is your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea story or stories?
I don't know if it was dangerous or epic or daring, but it certainly is the one that sticks with me the most about of all the ones I've been involved with. And I was actually the backup rescue swimmer. I had done some SAR cases, and some other friends of mine that shot this guy, Mike Thomas, had done a SAR case where he got hit in the head with a basket. I had done a rescue that was pretty far offshore, and the Coast Guard started to ask the question, well, what happens if the swimmer gets hurt? You know, and then the answer was, well, it's over. Then he's going to stay down there in the water and be dead, and it's over. We can't, And so they said, well, maybe we were just talking like, well, if the SAR case is really far offshore, maybe we should bring a second one. And this was like the first time we decided like to do that. And there was a sailing vessel, Mirage, and it was a great mentor, a great guy still in the Coast Guard, Mike Odom. And it was actually another friend of ours duty day. It was Tommy Holward's duty day, and Tommy had called in sick, and he couldn't stand duty because he was sick. And so we were night shift, and we flipped a coin for the SAR case, and Mike won. But I went on as the second swimmer. And so the flight crew takes off. It was I'm trying to get all the names. It was Jay Balda. Mark Buffetti was the flight mech. And I can't remember the co-pilot's name, but his nickname was Yogi. Anyway,
Where were you guys coming out of? What air station were you at?
Sorry, Air Station Elizabeth City.
Okay.
Right, and the Mirage was a sailing vessel. It was 270 miles off the coast of Savannah. And it was this sailboat that had left Jacksonville with a captain and four guys who bought the boat but didn't know much about sailing.
Typical.
They were going to St. Thomas from Jacksonville, but they were 270 directly off Savannah. Right, so that's how well they were doing.
I navigate okay, and that's definitely the wrong direction.
Not yet. They're taking a hard. They're certainly taking a tack there. So, and Savannah couldn't go get them because Savannah's a closer air station, but they were in 65s and didn't have the legs for it. So we get in, we fly down, and
you guys are in HH-60s, right, Jayhawks?
We're in Jayhawks.
Yeah.
And so we're in a Jayhawk, and the C-130 is going to fly cover because anything over 100 miles in the C-130 flew cover. We flew down to, like, Beaufort to get gas, and so we could stretch our legs again, and we go out to the case. And right before we get out there, we're just going to go talk to them. We don't know. All we know is, they called, and we weren't sure what the plan was. And we get out, and the right as we get on scene, like, the cloud cover moves in, and this is in February, right? So it's pretty chilly out, and the clouds come over, and it takes away all visibility for the boat. There's no reference anymore, and and the seas are, they're not super crazy, and they were sailing down there, I don't know, maybe 18s or 15 to 18 footers, but windy, good 50 mile an hour or 50 knot, steady wind out there in Chile. And they had lost their life raft in a hard knockdown. And so the non-experienced sailors were freaking out, and the captain was like, "We're fine." And the uninitiated won it off. The four guys that owned the boat won it off, and the captain, who they had, you know, paid to take the boat down with them to St. Thomas, hey, he's got all his stuff on there, his license. He goes, "I'm fine. I can make it to St. Thomas." And so we decided we would, you know, control the situation from the helicopter. And Jay says, "Well, either everyone comes off or no one comes off." And then, as we're having this discussion with the captain, we're hovering over. There's a spotlight on the sailboat, and this guy just jumps overboard. He really wanted off. He's like, "I don't know what they're talking about. I'm getting off," and he jumps off. And that was it. Now the decision's made for us, and we put Mike down into the water. Goes down on the cable to go get this one guy. And, you know, it's pretty cold, pretty serious sea state for him to deal with. And I think because of the no reference in the harbor, you know, there's a certain amount of, well, you know, the aircraft, there's no stable platform. The ocean's moving up and down, and the aircraft's moving up and down and side to side, and you're trying to dangle this cable at exactly the right spot in between it. It's not easy work for the flight mech and the pilot at all. And so when they would take, say, they might put someone in the basket, he put their victim in the basket, and when the hoist would happen, you know, if he was off center, then there's a pretty significant swing that happens, and there's wind, and so the cable swings around a lot. At the time, the H-60 design on the door edge, now it's a nice hardened piece of stainless that's rounded over, right? Back then, it was this straight-edge, knife-edge piece of aluminum, right? And the cable was hitting this knife edge. The cable was swinging so much that the cable was coming into contact with the helicopter.
That's a heck of a time to realize a design flaw.
Yeah, well,
right.
That's how we learn.
Yeah.
That's why it's stainless now. This case is why it's stainless. So it hits the knife edge, and every time it does, it was like digging a little groove in the aluminum.
Right.
And it's popping. It's hitting. We had an external fuel tank for extra range, and it's hitting the fuel tank, and it's a little bit of a train wreck. Like, every hoist is not the way. This isn't like training, you know. And then the boat's, of course, underway, so we have to go pick up Mike and then bring him back to the boat, and we're still trying to talk, like, "Okay, listen, guys, hold on," and then the other guy jumps off. Okay. And so Mike goes down again and gets the other guy, right? And he's looking pretty gassed, just because there's a lot of swimming involved, and I know he's a rescue swimmer. Well, that's great in the pool, but try swimming in, you know, 18 footers and wind and break and chop on top, and he's hot. Now I go, "You all right?" He's like, "I'm hot. Like, I'm just hot." He's in a dry suit and he's working really hard, and so the fact that the water's cold isn't really affecting him. He's just hot. And I said, "Do you want me to go?" He says, "Let me get one more and then you'll go." You know, I'm like, "All right." So he goes back down again, get the second victim up. Same problem. It's banging against the helicopter. It's popping off and hitting the fuel tank. It's hitting the fuel tank and then popping off in the helicopter. And every time the cable hits that door edge, it digs this little groove in it.
Could you see the groove, Mario? Like, before, while this was going? Well, yeah, you could see it happening. Yeah.
I'm holding it. It's usually just a flight mech up there. It's me, Mark, the face of the flight mech. And we're both trying to keep the cable from touching the helicopter. Like, I have my leg, I'm laying flat on the deck with my feet against the bulkhead of the 60 in the cabin, and my hands stiff-armed on the cable, and I couldn't keep it off the door edge. It's a pendulum down there. There's a 250-pound dude in it, and it's swinging back and forth, and I just wasn't winning the leverage fight, and it would hit the door edge anyway. So we're trying to keep it off. We're putting our boots on it. We're trying everything we can, but it's just not working. But nothing's happening other than we don't like it, so we don't have much of a choice. We just press on. And we get Mike up again, and when Mike, it's a lot of violent swinging, and Mike's hit the door edge a couple times. When he's on the cable hits the door edge. And then we hover back over to the boat, and the third guy jumps off. I mean, they're not even talking anymore.
They figured it out now.
Right. Yeah, once I'm in the water, they'll come get me.
Yeah, they'll come get me. So the third guy jumps off. Again, no one's set up. No one's telling them to jump off. They're just doing it. So we're like, well, this is the story we dealt. So, and Mike goes in to get the third guy. He puts the third guy in the basket. Now he's hitting the door. Now it hits the fuel tank, gets caught up on the fuel tank, hits the door edge, the cable, with this guy swinging below. And then the cable slides forward across all those serrations it had made. And the cable just starts shredding. It just strand by strand just starts popping, pop, 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 pop. It just keeps, it's coming apart. And the strands that pop are unraveling down towards the guy and up towards the hoist.
Right, you got all that tension on there, yeah.
Right, and he's about 100 feet above the water. And now Buffy's got a choice, right? If it goes and this guy drops, is it going to drop on Mike? Are they both going to die, or just this guy? And it was just a train wreck. You've got Buffy had like half a millisecond to pick up or down on the hoist, and he picked up because the guy was right there close to the door. So he picks the guy up, pulls him into the cabin, and sets the basket down. This guy gets out of the basket, and now he's got this shredded cable with like a few strands left on it, and it won't come out of the hoist. Like it's gone up there and bird caged or something.
Right.
And the hoist is done. This is also where we learned that if your hoist goes out, there's absolutely no way to get the swimmer back. So the sailboat's now gone. Mike's in the water looking up at us, and we have no way to get him out, and we're 270 miles offshore. So now we're trying to figure this out. Like the hoist is not working. There's nothing's going to make the cable come out of there. We have a quick splice. If we can get enough cable out, we can cut it off and put a quick splice and a fresh hook on there. It's an emergency thing, but it works. And that was our plan for a broken cable. But if it won't come out of the drum, it doesn't matter.
Right, so nested in there.
Yeah, we had nothing. And so that's it. So we're all just sort of, you know, and now what? And then the co-pilot yells, bingo.
Which is,
hey, I don't know what we're doing, but, you know, this is it. It's time to go.
You know what's so funny is, like, from a boat force's perspective, when the Hilo finally calls bingo, you're like, yes, it's over, right? But, yeah, I could only imagine there. Yeah, well, it takes on a whole new meaning.
Coming at it from the cutterman perspective, doing a lot of pursuit, when they called bingo, it was like, oh, now I actually have work to do.
Yeah, now I got to do it. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we weren't thinking about you guys at all. Don't worry about it. But they call us bingo, and so we know that does. It's not set at, you know, the halfway point. It's not like we're definitely going to not make it back when they yell bingo. It's just like, okay, you're digging into anything you have left that's a reserve. And so he has a one man life raft we can throw out, or we can just kick out the helicopter life raft that holds four, the bigger one, like the real one. And the sea state was such that I'm thinking, like, give them the real one. Like, the little one's not enough. And so we kicked him out the life raft, the helicopter life raft, which is actually okay, because never in the history of helicopters has a life raft inside the helicopter made it outside the helicopter if a helicopter ditches. And so I wasn't worried about needing the life raft. Oh, you're not going to get that thing anyway. And so we kicked the helicopter out, and Mike just looks at us like, because he doesn't know. We hadn't got him on the radio. Are you serious? He's like, what? You know, and I know, all I remember is he was hot and tired like last time I saw him. And now we kick him out of life raft, and we kick it out, and I'm like, wait for him to inflate. And let's clear this up. The idea of putting me down in there with him was discussed for half a second, and Baldo was just deposed like there's no way. Like, because we all think we've, at this point, I know what all of us are thinking is, that's it. He's going to die. Because, I mean, how many PIW flights or searches have you guys been on where you find nothing? Right? It's really, really hard to find someone.
Needle in a haystack, literally.
Right, and it's cold. And so the idea is, hey, I'm going to put you in a life raft out 270 miles offshore in February. How do you like your chances? Right, so we kick the life raft out. They're not going to put me in. When there's no way to get me in, there's no cable to put me down on, you know, free fall. I'd love to tell you, like, I was raring to get out there. I have no idea. I don't remember. All I remember is I think he's going to die. And I know what bingo means. And, you know, there was some discussion about, like, using the trail lines, which is an absurd idea. There's no way we're going to pick him up, you know, with a rope. And I've talked more about it now than we had time to talk about it then. We kicked the life raft out, and then we flew off in the direction of, you know, the beach. And Yogi's trying to get him on the radio. And I think for about 5 or 10 minutes while we're flying away, I made him stay. I said, wait till it inflates. Because in my mind, I had done maintenance on life rafts, and I just wanted to see it inflate before he flew off. He got to it, and he didn't immediately inflate it. He was kind of, I think he was trying to figure out, did we drop it? Like, how that happened. And then I wanted to wait for him to inflate it. And him and I both had pulled those things and had them not work. And so I wanted to see it inflate before we decided to take off with the smaller life raft. And it inflated, and he climbed in it, and then we flew off. And then he comes up on the radio and he's trying to reach us, and I think we're trying to reach him, and we stepped on each other for a while and couldn't make comms with him. And then the C-130, of course, was there, and the C-130 had gotten comms with him. Now, we're flying back, and at this point, I'm like, well, I'm not doing well, because he was my boss, and he was, without question, my best friend. And I'm not very hopeful, because I knew what his condition was. He didn't get in there fresh as a day. He was gassed when we left him. And now he's got to survive in a life raft, and the sea state is not conducive to life raft life. I don't know if you've ever been in a life raft for a long period of time, but if I can put you in the pool in one with the cover up and shake it, and you're going to get seasick and want to come out. So he's out there, and he's not in a good spot in the world. So I'm just in the back of the helicopter. I'm crying. Buffy's sitting there looking like it's his fault. Jay Bald is up front flying the plane thinking it's his fault. I'm in the back thinking it's mine, and none of us are doing well, and it's really quiet. And we're flying back. And one of the survivors, like a half hour, you know, it's a long flight. You know, we're 270 off. And he looks over at me, and he's like, when are you going to get my friend? Because he's looking for the other guy. He didn't know that we were moving. He thought we were still in a hover, you know, and the doors closed. He couldn't figure out what was going on. And I told him, I said, I point to the cable. I go, the cable broke. Our swimmer's in a life raft in the water, and I don't know where your friend is. And there's radio chatter going. The guys are talking. The C-130's talking to him. We're not hearing it. So we just know that he's being communicated with. And then... Now, we went out there the winds were 50 knots, and the way back was into a headwind. So the co-pilot's job, they have a pretty slick computer program now. I think back then they did fuel, what they call fuel calcs, where they check the burn rate, they check the level of fuel, they fly for 15 minutes and then check the level of fuel and then do math, right? On how far, how much more flying we're going to do.
Thank God for computers.
Right. And so that's the co-pilot. That's Yogi doing fuel count. And he goes, expletive. Shoot, right?
Right.
He throws one of those out. And the pilot goes, what? And he goes, nothing. I'm doing it again. And he does another fuel count. And he goes, yeah, with Wilmington, was the closest point of land to us. He goes, yeah, we're not going to make Wilmington. And Jay says, well, what are we going to make? We're going to make about 40 miles before Wilmington.
We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor. We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum, and that number is 5.
There are 5 theme storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
The exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum.
And here's our favorite 5. For as little as $5 a month, you can be a plank owner and support construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to coastguardmuseum.org/out. That's coastguardmuseum.org/OUT.
And so that's, all right, we're going to ditch. Because there was no Navy helicopter. There was no Navy out there. Or otherwise they'd have done the SAR case. Because I think that the Coast Guard was working on that option and it wasn't an option. So now we're flying back, and we've got about an hour left to decide, you know, when we want to ditch. And now I'm in the back on Mike's bed, and now I'm not going to see Mike. And I'm in the back trying to figure out, and I was the guy that taught you how to escape from the aircraft. And I'm in the back of the helicopter trying to figure out, is it going to hurt to freeze to death in the water, not in a life raft? Or am I going to drown trying to get out of the helicopter? Like, which one of those two? Like, how am I going to die, this way or that way? Because it's going to be one of the two. Because if we ditch, no life raft, in the water, in dry suits, that's a couple few hours. We don't have personal EPIRBs on at the time. They didn't have that. You know, I had an ELT, so maybe that would work. But, you know, this is back when it was all 121.5 ELTs.
Yeah, somebody had to be out there with an EF, right, to find you?
You had to be out there pretty close, and it was not going to, you know, even like a 121.5 EPIRB, the accuracy of those things was within 3 to 5 miles or 3 to 15 miles for a 121.5 EPIRB, and the DF worked out to about 9. So it was possible for the Rescue and Coordination Center to give you a lat and long that was out of the range of your DF.
Right.
So anyway, I wasn't very hopeful. So I'm in the back going, which way, how are we going to die? Like freezing to death or drowning? Which one's going to be worse? And these aren't thoughts I'm proud of. This is just what I was thinking. I don't call them good or bad thoughts. It's just what it was. I just remember that was what I was thinking. And the command, to find out later, the command is going nuts with now 2 pretty serious problems. They've got a swimmer in a life raft 270 offshore, and they got a helo with 3 survivors and 3 crew who don't have enough gas to get back. And they're trying to solve both problems, I assume. And it was Stan Walls. Captain Stan Walls was the captain of the air station, and he's now, of course, in the command center. And he's looking for a Navy ship, you know, for us or for, it's like, where's the Navy? There's got to be Navy out here somewhere. And the young watch officer says, we called, there's no one. He goes, what did you say? I asked him if they had any Navy ships in the area. And he went, he went, no. And he picked up the phone and he calls the Navy, whatever it's called, the Navy Command Center or the liaison at the RCC and says, I've got a guy in the water about to die and a helicopter about to ditch. Do you have any ashes? Oh, yeah, the Ticonderoga is like 50 miles away. Could have done the whole mission, right? They could have done the whole sailboat mission. And so now in Elizabeth City, they can't launch another helicopter because the other 2 helicopters were down for maintenance. They're scrambling trying to get a helo back. Our helo, the C-130 is running out of gas. They cut down 2 engines so they could stay on scene longer. The case is being run out of District 7. District 7 is telling the CO of Air Station Elizabeth City that don't launch your C-130. We're going to launch one out of Clearwater. And Stan Walls, because he knows that we would get there like a half hour sooner, and he says, you can launch anything you want, but I'm launching mine too. And he launched a C-130 to relieve the other one that was from Elizabeth City, so Mike wouldn't be alone out there. And so that goes on. And all we know in the helicopter is that we're counting fuel. We're counting, you know, we keep doing fuel calcs. And about halfway back, you know, we made it, obviously, because her name's talking to you. About halfway back, the wind just did this 180 swap in the other direction, and now it was a tailwind. So we landed in Wilmington with 180 pounds of gas on the gauges. They're plus or minus 200. We whispered the hell in. We whispered in, and with 180 pounds on the gauges, which is just nothing. And then I remember we opened the door and it was just freezing, like 17 degrees cold, just freezing. And I thought, yeah, he's not going to make it. And we're just three useless guys with a bad helicopter and in an airport in the Wilmington, in some Wilmington municipal little like, tiny airport with these three other guys who we're pretty pissed off at because we're blaming everybody. And anyway, chase to the end. Before the Navy takes off to attempt to go get Mike, but one of our helos got there like right in front of them. Like, I think the Navy might have watched them do the rescue, and they went down. And Mike was he had been kicked out of the raft. He had been washed out of the raft by waves and climbed back in, and washed out and climbed back in. He was throwing up, seasick, and he tied himself to the life raft because he didn't want us to have to find his body, or he didn't want to have to search for his body. He knew he was going to die, but he wanted to die in the raft so we wouldn't have to look for him for 3 days. So they found him. He had tied himself into the life raft and he was unconscious.
Man, crazy story.
Right. So, it was Jim Peterson was a swimmer that went down, and Bruce Jones, who was the pilot. He's now the mayor of Astoria. Jimmy goes down onto the raft and Mike's out. And when he straddles over him, Mike reaches up and grabs Jim's mask and he's up. So up into the helicopter he goes. They're cutting off his dry suit and they fly him to the Ticonderoga, who takes him down to the medical and puts warm IVs in him and brings him back. You know, he almost could have gone back on the helicopter, but they wouldn't let him out of medical yet.
Right.
And he was standing duty 2 days later.
Testament to that guy, for sure.
Bulletproof and fine, yeah. So Mike's not here for sure. But that was, as SAR cases go, one of the most, you know, instructive. And, you know, I learned more from that case. And I put, when I got back to the shop, I scribbled out a sign. I scribbled out a note on a piece of paper on my desk, and I hung it in my house first. And now I've got a really nice plaque version of it on my desk now, because that one gave me perspective. And the note, what I wrote down was, "I've been to where bad is, and this is not it."
For sure.
And yeah. That was my takeaway from my case. Okay, that was bad. You know, people have had worse, but that was the worst time of my life. That was bad. And so anywhere not there is good.
Right.
So I got the sign on my desk. I'm looking at it right now. I said, "I've been to where bad is, and this is not it." And that's what I took away from that SAR case mostly.
I do have to ask, Mario, do you know whatever happened with the sailboat and the other guys that were on it?
Yeah, I do know what happened with the sailboat. They made it fine to St. Thomas. They made it fine to St. Thomas. I think the worst that would have happened they made the best decision they could with the information they had.
Sure, right. Sure, yeah. Not victim shame, just seeing, yeah, I mean, for sure. You never know how it's going to work out.
They also made it But all their food was stacked up because they didn't have enough food for five guys. It would have been a miserable trip, but I think they would have made it.
Right.
Doesn't mean it was, you know, right, wrong, or indifferent. You know, mostly learned, one is we ought to have another way to pick up the swimmer, right?
Right.
That doorage thing's ridiculous. Let's fix that. You know, so those things happen. But that SAR case was the beginning of a lot of frustration for me in my career because the rescue swimmer program wasn't terribly old at this point. And when the standardization team came to sort of debrief what had happened, and it was a personality thing. The guys that did that had the wrong personality for the job at the time, and there was more blame than there needed to be.
That was the most politically correct way to put the old stand team mindset that I think anybody could ever do. Yeah, that was.
I was gonna say, I think every community struggled with that.
Yeah,
with
it wasn't just aviation.
The old standardization team mottos.
Well, on the chance that there's some never been in civilians, I didn't want to say that.
Nope, you were spot on. Yeah, that was
okay.
Good.
Yeah, they were. It was a different time. It was a new program, and it just wasn't the right personalities on that team, and they were sort of blaming. We're both getting deeper. If you're like, well, you know, hey, you were supposed to drink water. You didn't drink water. Why did you? You know, they're getting on Mike. Why didn't you drink any water? He's like, well, I'm glad you mentioned that. Like, because you make us tie the water in with overhand square knots, followed by overhand knots, and it's cold. I couldn't untie the knots. Like, I couldn't get to the water. I couldn't. My hands wouldn't move, and I couldn't untie the water bags to get the water out of the life raft. And they, well, why don't you use your knife? Because I was in a rocking life raft that was kicking me out with waves. I didn't think pulling my knife out was a good idea in the raft.
Probably a wise choice.
And he would have these suggestions that they would shoot down as terrible ideas, which are all in place now, by the way. Like, every suggestion Mike had to improve the life raft and improve the swimmer gear is in place now. But when he first said it, it was a terrible idea. And I'm just sitting there, you know, getting angry. I was younger, you know. I got angry, or I got mad when I was younger. But I walked out of that meeting, and I remember asking, "Who are these?" And I didn't know what the stand team was. I had not had my first stand visit. Like, I was a new swimmer. This is all my first 7 months as a rescue swimmer, and so I was like, "Who are those guys?" And when they told me, I realized, you know, at the time, through no fault of anybody's, the number one, number two, and number three guy in the rescue swimmer program had never stood duty as an operational rescue swimmer.
And it wasn't that. Also, not a problem confined to the aviation community.
Right.
Right. Well, you know, someone had to be the first stand team. And so,
right,
not
no,
like
for sure. They, you're right.
Right. Give me the most experienced guy in the Coast Guard. There's the guy. He's got no experience. And so it wasn't, and that's not necessarily wrong, but the perspective that gave me was, oh, my opinion's just as valid as anyone else's because we're all guessing right now. Like, this is too new a program. Like, we're figuring it out, you know. And it was okay to have an idea. And it was okay to ask, why did we do this? Like, and forget the stand team of swimmers. The knife edge on the door. I can imagine the guys at Sikorsky going, well, there's no way the cable's ever going to get over here. It's 2 feet away. Right?
Right, until you're 200 plus miles offshore and it's smacking it. Yeah.
Right. And so then they fixed that one pretty quick. But it was one of those things where until it had happened, it wasn't a problem.
And what so, did you, so with your ideas, what did you propose any yourself? Like, you said you were in the back getting mad. I 100% believe that. I can just imagine your friend there, you know, trying to express, hey, we're doing it wrong, and then keep telling them no. What did you personally take as the number two swimmer in the Hilo that day?
I just wanted there to be, and it was funny. It was the second time I'd been at the air station for like under 7 months, and that was the second time a hoist failed. That one was the cable, my very first swimmer flight, the very first time I got in a helicopter and got out and got into the water, I had to stay there and get picked up by the small boat because the hoist wouldn't work. And it was, and I was with Mike Thomas. He was like the instructor I was with. And Mike, I'm like, has that happened before? He goes, I've never seen it. And then we're just in the, we're like in the, we're in Hartford, North Carolina, in some, in the Chowan River or something, doing ops. And the, and these guys pick us up, and we gotta get a, you know, a long truck ride back to the base. And so mine was, can you get like another hoist? Not like a backup hoist thing. It's, you know, that was mine. I mean, isn't there another way to get another hoist in here? Terrible idea. This thing's cost money.
Right. And,
right. We still don't. I mean, we still don't. Now they came out and they sort of half invented this thing called the ERD. And I think they're still using the ERD, the ERD, the emergency recovery device, which is basically just a Harkin winch from a sailboat and a couple of pulleys. And you just sort of, the flight mate just has to go to town. It's like a hook on a rope in a bag, and they drop it out. And this takes about 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes to get up 30 feet.
Some old school mechanical advantage there, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, some old school mechanical advantage.
Well, you know when somebody calls out, like, get out the ERD. Like, right. I mean, it, just, yeah. It doesn't even sound like a cool, you know, the ERD.
No.
Like, man, this is going to suck. Yeah.
No. And you know, you look now at some of the helicopter rescues really advanced, and my new job really lets me see that a lot. But it's a lot of operators have just two hoists. They just put two hoists on the helicopter now just for that reason, you know.
Right, just a lot safety
of
backup.
Bristow and CAC. They have two complete identical hoist systems.
Crazy. Mario, what a phenomenal story, man. I didn't even know where that one's going.
You hit epic, dangerous, and daring in that one. You got all three for sure.
Yeah, and you know, given your career background, I honestly didn't know where we were going to go with that one. I didn't know what was going to. I knew you made it somehow, but I didn't know what it was going to be.
That's it. Well, that's the one that I, you know, keeps me, that I still think about at night sometimes.
Dude. I'm sure.
It's perfect. Sure. I think one of the biggest lessons for, you know, especially like the, I guess any listener, but especially those younger ones, is that it gave you kind of a voice, right? Allowed you to realize like, hey, my opinion does matter. I was there. I experienced it. Had a guest before say, you know, leadership is based on experience, period.
Right.
I believe that wholeheartedly.
Go ahead, Mario.
I'm saying that there's two schools of thought there for now I'm not going to put it that way for the new people in the Coast Guard. I think one is your opinion is completely valid, whatever, because it's just an opinion. You can't hurt anybody with it. But also, I think one of the lessons is the unaccounted for variables. Like, what are you not thinking of? What I loved most about the Coast Guard compared to the Navy was the Coast Guard usually always made sense to me. Like, if there was something I didn't like, I'd go talk to somebody, and there was like, they'd give me the one thing I wasn't thinking about. Like, okay, that's a good idea. Right?
The Navy so, must be completely backwards. No, I'm just kidding. Just kidding.
Right. There was a lot of just busy work and stuff that didn't make much sense that we would do.
He's not totally
a larger organization. Right. And so... So I think too, your opinion is valid, but most of the regulations and the rules that you live under were written in someone's blood, you know, and to ask why more often than you criticize. Like, don't criticize, you know, just respectfully ask why. Like, why can't I have the knife on the front, you know?
Right.
Or why can't I have a folding knife, or why can't I have, you know, can I have better radio comms? Like, you know, why? Because there may be a reason. You know, often it's money, and I get it. Why can't we have two hoist money? For sure. But that there may be a really valid reason why things are the way they are. But there just may be. There may not be. And so the only way you find out is by asking and bringing it up. Your opinion is valuable. Don't worry about looking stupid about it, because there's a good chance that maybe somewhere in your world of work someone's guessing.
Right.
Right.
Right. And I think what's interesting too, I mean, I feel like every story we've had, and we've had some people with some pretty long careers on, a couple of warrant officers now, you know, people who have gone the whole way to retirement. It's always the stuff you said you were a pretty new rescue swimmer at the time. You know, you'd been in a little bit because you'd done some other stuff, but the people that are out there doing this job, even today, every day, and doing a lot of the really impactful stuff are such junior people. And yeah. And the other thing I get is, not only if you're junior, don't be afraid to ask, but as you get more senior, be willing to answer those questions, because they might have thought of something you didn't think of. And if you can't explain why, then why do we do it?
Right. Well, that's my, I was not very popular in the chief mess, because I look at the chief's always right. No, he's not, or she's not. And they're not always right, because you're, I mean, it's a fun thing to say in the chief's mess, but it's not true. She's always right. No, not even close, And so the idea that if you can't explain to an E4 who's new in the Coast Guard why something's a certain way, maybe it shouldn't be that way. Like, there's your sign, right? There's your litmus test for, is there a good policy or a good procedure? If you can't explain why it is that way, if you're not bright enough after 15 years in the service to articulate to the young new person why you do things a certain way, perhaps the kid's right and you shouldn't do it that way. And so the lessons go both ways, I think.
Solid advice. Yeah, ranges from the whole spectrum. Perfect. I love that. I love the way you phrased it. Well, Mr. Vitone, a phenomenal story. Thank you so much for sharing it. I know I took a ton of lessons out of it. I'm sure our audience will too. I want to steer the listeners to where they can learn more about you. Could you tell us about that?
If you're really bored and you want to learn more about me, you can go to.
He's being modest. He's being modest.
You can go to my. You can go to my website, which is just mariovitone.com. And my pesky day job now that I love, and I'm sort of still in the Coast Guard, but not, is I'm the general manager of Life Saving Systems that makes some gear on a boat or helicopter near you.
Yeah, so, I'd say.
So thanks for trusting us with the equipment. We're having fun.
Solid. And again, that's mariovitone.com, and you can read a ton of articles that Mr. Vitone's published, and anybody up in D9 preparing for ice rescue next year can see him on the cold water boot camp from the cold water boot camp video from back when he was a young AST. That's where I first caught the name. But again, sir, thank you very much for being with us, and we really appreciate your time. We'd love to have you back on if you're ever willing.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Great. Thank
awesome,
you, sir.
Mario, thank you.
Bye.
Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org. That's CoastGuardFoundation.org to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Another one to check out is the Always Ready Collective, which delivers art by and for some daring fighters of the sea. Head over to Etsy, Facebook, or Instagram and search Always Ready Collective to check out their Coast Guard and Maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. You won't be disappointed. Anyone who gets one of their designs inked on their body will get featured on their feed and can be sent a care package on the house. Find a design you like, some blank canvas, and get it done. Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooout.com or your favorite podcast platform. And like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.